The Rufus Project would like to advise the following podcast contains spoilers for Masters of the Universe from 1987. If you do not wish to have this movie spoilt, please watch it before listening to the following podcast. Does it have the power, or should it have been cut off? We watched Masters of the Universe from 1987 to see if we could redeem it. Were we successful? Find out after the theme.
Boy, oh boy.
Is it good to be bad? So bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? Got bad. I love dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy.
Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project podcast, this time checking out Masters of the Universe from 1987. I am one of your hosts, Trevor Holland, and I am joined by the suggester of this movie, co-host, and my good friend,
Christian Fletcher. I say that with a bit dubious because, yeah, I'd never thought I'd be linked to a movie of this kind, so, but thanks for having me here, Trevor.
We had to get it to it eventually. I mean, we checked out the Christmas special. Actually, was it last year we did this?
I have a feeling it was the most recent one. Like, luckily, I kind of had a bit of knowledge of that still in my brain when I saw this, having no recollection of He-Man, even I think I vaguely watched it when I was a kid. But yeah, so that was probably all I was going off. So, yeah, it was quite recent, I think.
Yeah, actually, no, it was a couple. We did We Wish You a Turtle Christmas last
Christmas.
Oh,
that's Christmas, right.
The He-Man and She-Ra Christmas special was the year before.
So it's soon good,
we forget.
It's good to see we're continuing the, I suppose, the He-Man tradition. And I'm sure, you know, I don't know what's in the works, but I'm sure there's probably a He-Man live-action movie in the works. I don't know.
Who knows? I think there's always something in the works somewhere. It's just whether or not it actually makes it to the screen, like this one did.
Oh, I was going to say, it seemed like a very topical choice, because this was kind of like our Josie and the Pussycats, the movie I think we'd spoken about. Have we seen this? No, we need to see this. So that was probably more where I was coming from suggesting this movie. So we can continue knowing that.
Absolutely. So if you haven't seen Masters of the Universe, or He-Man as the Master of the Universe, as I think I have seen it referred to as well, I have a synopsis here for you. The heroic warrior He-Man battles against the evil Lord Skeletor and his armies of darkness for control of Castle Grayskull.
That does do a good job of summing up. However, I think one, I can't remember which one I saw going in, sort of had the human element of He-Man and his, I suppose, gang or company going to Earth and them having to join him in the fight for Skeletor. So very close there. But yeah, I think going in with the plot summary that you said, I think of a very different movie.
Yeah, I mean, really, I mean, I don't want to talk too much of the movie yet, but I mean, when this movie starts, battle for the castle is pretty much over, except for a few ragtag people who refuse to give up. But we shall get back to that, I am sure.
And I think they pretty much, they didn't just establish probably what had been established in the cartoons. Because as you could probably guess from what I've been saying, my knowledge of He-Man is virtually non-existent. So I'll say I'm going into this completely blind.
Now, before we get too much into the movie itself, we do need to look at whether or not it got any awards, and it sure did. So, for Masters of the Universe, the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy and Horror Films, it was nominated for a Saturn Award for Best Costumes and Best Special Effects, and it won the Silver Scroll Award for Outstanding Achievement for Gary Goddard, I think was the director. I'm not actually too sure of this from my head. I probably should double check that. Yes, he was the director. Excellent. The Fantasporto Awards, which were, I believe, Spanish. It was nominated for the International Fantasy Film Award for Best Film for Gary Goddard, and it won the Best Special Effects. And there was a Razzie nomination for the worst supporting actor, being Billy Barty, who played Gwildor.
Oh, Is that the troll? Like, I've pretty much got him written in my notes as.
Yes, yes.
Okay, the, yes.
The fantasy novelty character? Yeah. I don't know what you would call him.
We will get to him.
I should know what I would call him.
Well, yeah.
But we'll get back to that.
It's funny because the whole time I'm watching this, I'm having to stop and jump over to Wikipedia and just look at He-Man characters just to see what the similarities are. In a lot of cases, I was impressed with the live-action version. But again, we don't want to get into the movie too much.
Not at all, because we do also have to cover over our turkey trivia as well. So this is where we talk turkey about the movie and then trivia. I say that every single time. I think it's self-explanatory, so why do I keep saying a Christian? I don't know. I'm going to move on. So, this one is rated 5.4 out of 10 on IMDb. It had a budget of $22 million, and its box office, $17
million. Ooh, and look, you know, not knowing my history of the 80s that well in terms of merchandising, but I'm assuming this was at the period where He-Man was, I suppose, at his most popular as a cartoon series. So, yeah, I find it quite strange that it didn't actually succeed, but it possibly could be like us looking at, I don't know, a live-action Simpsons in this day and age, and kind of maybe it was sort of greeted with the same thought. So I'm actually surprised the fandom didn't actually give it a bigger box office.
Yeah, I think by this stage, the merchandise for the cartoons would have been well and truly established, so it'd be kind of interesting to sort of, like, you know, merchandising a Dolph Lundgren version of He-Man as opposed to a comic book, well, a cartoon version action figure. Yeah, let's just, I'm not too sure what the appeal would be for the Dolph Lundgren version over the original cartoon version.
I see what
you
mean.
But again, we should get back to that.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry.
Now, with a bit of the trivia. Now, Frank Langella, who played Skeletor, went on to record in an interview saying that playing Skeletor was one of his favourite roles, mainly because his young son was a big fan and was running around the house shouting, "By the power of Grayskull!" So that's why Frank agreed to the role. He even wrote some of his own lines, like, "Tell me about the loneliness of good He-Man. Is it equal to the loneliness of evil?"
And you can tell, even beneath the skull, if you can call it that, mask, he still seems like he's having a good time. So I'm sure his son was quite happy about that.
Yeah, I'm probably going to mention it multiple times, but yeah, Frank Langella was having one hell of a time in this movie.
And that's the thing that seems to be about these costumed sort of epics that we watch, you know, these fantasy movies. There always seems to be one that stands out that's just usually the villain that's just having the greatest time while the rest of them are playing it oh so seriously. But we'll talk about that soon. But I don't know if I'm stepping on toes here with trivia, but I know we've looked at a movie by Canon Films before, and that was The Apple. Probably a couple of years ago now. Sorry to remind you of that movie, and it was probably through that movie that I was familiar with Canon Films and the whole 80s, I suppose, trash background that they had with releasing films. And this was very much a film of them and of that time. And I believe because it went so badly, it kind of caused the collapse of Canon Films. So I don't know if it's a movie to be celebrated.
Yeah, I was gonna, yeah, because the opening with Canon, it was my first note, was like, oh, that's right, this is a Canon film. Yeah, but things like Master of the Universe, The Apple, and didn't they do Breaking 2, Electric Boogaloo, which I think is a very popular, almost meme-like quality to that movie.
Oh, yeah, even if no one's, I think it's even famous because it's got Jean-Claude Van Damme in a leotard breakdancing. So I think that's kind of why it's got a bit of infamy around it as well.
Wow, that's just gone right on my list for potential future.
And you know what? I've never seen it. So I hope people haven't been lying to me. That better be in there.
Yeah, I've never seen it either. So it would be interesting. Now, speaking of bad guys, many viewers of the film have commented on actresses Meg Foster's eerily effective contact lenses, which gave the character of Evil Lynn the very sinister air. But she wore no contact lenses. Her eyes naturally have blue-grey irises and tiny pupils, giving her that appearance. And apparently she's being cast in science fiction and fantasy roles quite a lot because of them. And she jokes that that the appeal to casting director is she brings her own special effect with her for free.
Hey, if I was being cast in Hollywood movies only based on one thing, I'd run with it. So it sounds like she's made it work for her. So and I was really quite, I suppose not excited, it's not the word, but intrigued when I saw Courtney Cox coming appear in this movie. I was not expecting that, having just seen Dolph Lundgren as the star. I was really surprised to see her in this.
Yeah, well, I mean, this was one of, I think this was Dolph Lundgren's like first real American movie, and it's also Courtney Cox's first feature film.
Probably all I could think the whole time was post, is it Dancing in the Dark, where she does the cameo in the Bruce Springsteen clip? It was about 84, so I'm sure she's been doing stuff between those in those 3 years. But it's always good to see a familiar face, and as we'll touch on, I wasn't assuming that we'd be seeing the humans in this film, you know, based on the outset.
Absolutely. But one thing you did mention before was, I suppose, the costumes and the characters. And apparently they weren't that great to wear, because Meg Foster's costume weighed about 45 pounds. Not sure what that is in kilograms. I should look that up before, but it's too late now. The actress sustained bruises to her groin from the breastplate that she wears. And she said it was made of fiberglass, restricted her movements a great deal, which is why you never see her sitting down. And she said that the discomfort from the costume helped her performance, as the weight forced her to puff at her chest and contributed to her slinky posture.
It's kind of subliminal method acting in some way. But I probably shouldn't laugh. She's probably in pain. And that's the thing. You can understand these people going through such great lengths for a very iconic movie. But to have a movie that comes out and is a big, not received too well, or a big bomb, you think, oh, why did I put all that effort in?
Yeah. Well, apparently Beastman's prosthetic teeth made him drool so much that by the end of the shoot, his mask was heavier due to just the amount of saliva that it had been absorbed by the chin of the mask.
Oh. So anyone listening, if you see that on eBay, I wouldn't touch that.
I don't know. If you're a fan of Beastman, it'd be a bonus.
It'd be very heavy for postage, but anyway.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mattel, the company that owned and produced the Master of the Universe toy line, mandated that He-Man not be allowed to kill anyone on screen. So that means all of Skeletor's troops are robot soldiers, even though nobody in the movie actually tells you that.
Aha, uh-huh. If I'd known that going in. No, I was just thinking it was clever editing.
Yeah. Nope, they're all robots. Now, there was a sequel planned, which was to be titled Masters of the Universe 2 Cyborg, which was written, and it followed He-Man returning to Earth to battle Skeletor. And Skeletor had left Earth as a post-apocalyptic wasteland. It was to feature the characters Trapjaw, and She-Ra was also going to turn up, being his cousin. Cousin? I think cousin or sister? I can't remember.
I'm not sure. I thought it was
but
sister,
because of the film bombing, Mattel and Canon decided to cancel that production, and the script was rewritten to become the Jean-Claude Van Damme vehicle, Cyborg, in 1989.
Well, which answers the question I was going to ask, which was, I wonder if this would have come out in the 80s or the early 90s, but if it had been a 1989 movie, it would have made more sense. But I don't know, I think by the 90s it would have been waning a bit in terms of He-Man. But as we see with, spoiler alert, as we see with the stinger at the end of the movie, I had a feeling that they were hoping for a franchise or at least a sequel.
That's such a heavy-handed stinger, but we will come back to it. Now, the
so
final,
to the point.
The final, absolutely. Well, the final bit that I've got is a very odd link to two movies that I absolutely love. For the miniature shot set on Earth, the special effects men at Boss Film Studios reused buildings that were left over from Blade Runner and Ghostbusters to fill out the background.
And hey, did you know that trivia going in? I was just wondering if you saw any similarities.
I had absolutely no idea. I don't look at this stuff until after I watch the movie.
And it's funny because having now been to America and on the Universal tour, I think the amount of times I see things and think, oh my God, I wonder if that's it. And I'm like, okay, Christian, it probably wasn't.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think I mentioned last week, it's been a long, long time since I saw this movie. I may as well have been watching this fresh because I remembered very little about it. So it was as good as watching for the first time, I think.
I say it already grabbed me going in because, you know, I know we sort of, you know, I don't know, people poo-poo the whole kind of idea of live action over narration, but I'm a big fan. I grew up with the whole 1990s live action version of Ninja Turtles, so I was excited about this going in, considering it wasn't animation, because I'm not a big fan.
Fair enough. Well, before we get into the movie itself and talk about some of the things we experienced, I'll use that word for now, we need to set our baseline. So here on the Rufus Project, we take movies that bombed at the box office or have less than a stellar reputation and see if we can find it redeemable. What that means is we need to see what we're working from. So I've got a review here. The title of this review is The Killer of Childhoods. Someone didn't watch the cartoon. It's just a bad movie. The actor who plays He-Man is good, but that's about it. 1 star.
That's probably the shortest review you've ever had on here, Trevor.
It was this. The only other particularly decent review was an Epic Deconstruction, so I didn't really feel like using that one, but I did grab a bonus review.
Ooh.
If you want something a bit more juicy that I had to include. This one says, I hate it.
And that is it.
That is it.
But that said, if I really despise something enough to write a review on, say, IMDb or wherever this is, I wouldn't go into too much detail. I wouldn't waste too much time on that movie. So, okay, we can only really go up from here, Trevor, because they're pretty bad.
They are pretty bad. So, I was quite happy. Well, first of all, seeing that Canon logo was quite groovy, thinking about their catalog, knowing that if I delve into that, we could probably find a few more movies to check out, and the fact that it's under 2 hours, which is pretty promising.
And especially when I'm the suggester of the movie, I always am happy that I've suggested something under 2 hours.
But I believe the Christmas special was also under two hours, but felt like an eternity.
Oh, exactly. But I must admit, talking about the Canon logo, I did have a bit of wash. Sorry to mention the movie again, but a bit of a as soon as I saw the Canon logo, I thought, Trevor's going to think this is another Apple, isn't he? But we shall see.
I put the thoughts of the Apple did come straight into my head, and I pushed them out just as fast.
But at
I
least
didn't want that colouring my perception of this one.
My judgments. But hey, at least, look, we say Canon logo, but at least it segues straight into, you know, it doesn't waste any time with that kind of 80s soundtrack. But I don't know if it's just me, and it's probably because we sort of have two opening credits because there's a bit of a voiceover, and then we've got a second half to it. But the first half just seemed to be this boring blue screen of kind of looked like Jeopardy questions to me. So I was surprised they didn't decide just to do those psychedelic titles the whole way through.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it wasn't much there, and yeah, get to that bit of narration. It's always, you always know you got quality when they have to tell you the story before the movie starts.
Hey, I'm just happy I don't have to read a scroll, but it didn't seem to go on for too long, which was good. I can't say too much of it actually sunk in though.
Yeah, well, it did get to the point very, very quickly, and then that music. Oh, I mean, could they have gone any more bombastic of thinking, are they trying to top Star Wars?
Oh, exactly. Look, with my scores. Wow. I always get Superman and Star Wars and all those mixed up. But it's John Williams, isn't it? Anyway, whoever it ends up being. Yeah, oh my gosh, Star Wars was the big thing. Like, we'll just change a few notes and it's okay. I thought, are we watching Star Crash again?
Are you trying to give me pain, Christian?
Am I supposed to be giving you something to compare?
Do you just want to bring up Skidoo and go for the trifecta? God.
I'd only do that by singing the theme songs, so it's okay. But look,
if you do that, we may never speak again.
Look, let's move on past these credits. They're causing a bit of problem. But the one thing that struck me really immediately was how huge and huge is probably the right word, but lavish the sets were. Like, you know, there's been quite a lot of money thrown into this movie, especially to recreate the live action version of the world that He-Man fans were used to.
Yeah, well, that throne room where Skeletor turns up, and I certainly appreciated that it was a practical costume for Skeletor rather than trying late 80s CGI, even though some of that does creep in later. But yeah, even though, you know, poor old Franklin Jella behind the mask, you could tell he was trying to emote, not that much came through that mask.
Oh, yeah.
And Dolph Lundgren, I mean, he certainly does make an impressive He-Man.
Oh, definitely. You can tell he's giving it his all. Sort of, I read in a few reviews, he got compared a lot to Arnold Schwarzenegger, not saying he was in the same, I don't know, even to compare them is probably sacrilege, I don't know. But yeah, he definitely was in fine form and probably a good choice for He-Man and definitely fills the role well. But you mentioned Skeletor and you know, yeah, the first thing that struck me was, you know, having vague memories of the cartoon, you know, they've done a good job of that. You know, it might be the stuff of nightmares, but one thing I noticed too with the use of prosthetics, and we see later on with other characters that have masks and stuff, you see the limited movement in the mouth. Like, what was it, Frank? I can't remember the actor's name, but you could just see that he wanted to open his mouth so much more.
Yeah, he was ready to chew some scenery, but that movement of that mask and let him nibble.
But you mentioned Dolph Lundgren, and I thought, like, as soon as we first see him and he stumbles on the guy with the helmet, I'm going to have to ask you for names as we go through, but as soon as I see him, you know, battling in the, you know, around all those rocks and things, it just felt like a scene out of an 80s sword and sandal epic, like the Barbarians or something. So, yeah, so I think in that case, he definitely fits the mold quite well.
Indeed. And you mentioning that Schwarzenegger thing before, there could have been a stronger one. A little trigger I didn't mention that I found out was that they were worried because this was like Dolph Lundgren's first real English-speaking film where he was a major star. And they were talking about dubbing him at one point, apparently. So it could have been a whole Hercules in New York situation.
Oh,
so
Trevor, what are you trying to do? Bringing up these old movies. Gosh. You're going to have to dub this episode the Reminiscent. I don't know if Reminiscence, it needs to be something crueler than that. But anyway, I didn't want to. It's funny you say that because I was getting the whole Hercules in New York vibe very much through most of this movie. But okay, I'll try not to mention it. We'll try not to mention any more redeeming features movies. But it's funny how we, I mentioned the prosthetics and stuff like that. And straight away we go into the troll character. Now you're gonna have to remind me on his name because I tried so many times to remember it or work out what it was.
This is why I have the IMDb cast list open here.
Gwildor or something.
Gwildor. Gwildor.
Okay, good to know.
I know. I just call him the turd creature or something.
And that's the thing. It's funny in movies like this because I mentioned I like live action movies, but in sometimes a lot of characters kind of really stick out to you as being really out of place, and that was probably one of those ones that hit me straight away. And dare I say it, I thought as soon as I saw him, this guy's going to be the Jar Jar Binks of this movie. And no, that is not referencing another movie. I know we've done it before, but I wrote that note earlier. But yeah, that was my biggest fear. But then, you know, not knowing much about the cartoon, I assumed he was a sidekick of He-Man's or he was a bigger character. I'm not sure, but it just seemed that he played quite a big role in this movie as a bit of a sidekick for the group.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he was really much of a character from the cartoons or he just came in here because they needed someone to make these cosmic keys,
being the MacGuffin.
used to propel the plot and give everyone their motivation for whatever they need to do.
Because he seems to be...
It's all about finding the right tones.
Because that's the thing, he seems to be... It's funny because I mentioned that he's the Jar Jar Binks. Like, he was so annoying most of the way through, but he always seemed to be the guy that would sort of get them out of problems or solve a lot of things that they just couldn't. But then I think back and I'm like, hang on, didn't he get you in this problem in the first place because he's got the key?
Yeah, because I think because he's... like the smart character of the group. I mean, He-Man is just there being all strong and stoic, and for anyone who knows the cartoon, there is no sign of Prince Adam anywhere in this movie. It is He-Man all the way, no alter egos. The sidekicks, Duncan, the man at arms, Duncan.
Okay. And who is the woman's really just name? The character, that's the one that was getting me.
Yeah, and Teela, the one who for some reason had a costume with a bit of a strap going right up her butt for no apparent reason.
But it's funny because I don't know if they intended her to play some kind of, or it was supposed to be that she's some kind of love interest of He-Man. I didn't want to think that in case she was supposed to be his sister or something. But it was funny because as we see later on, whenever there's reference to Courtney Cox, you don't know if she's, you kind of get this jealousy part about her. So I don't know where she comes in with that.
Well, towards the end when they're having like their emotional farewells, I know I'm jumping ahead, but you know, we don't want to recap this thing. It was almost the way she sort of said, "Oh, don't say goodbye, say good journey." I thought she looks like she wants to kiss Courtney Cox, which is fine, but you know, there'd be no sign of anything like this throughout the rest of the movie. In fact, the only romantically linked couple being Courtney Cox. Courtney Cox's Julie and her boyfriend.
Was it Jimmy?
Well, not even boyfriend for a lot of the movie. Kevin.
Kevin. I just called him boyfriend the whole way through. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, there doesn't seem to be much chemistry between them. And at the start of the movie, she's actively talking about the fact that she is leaving him, yet he still has to pick her up and take her to the airport so that she can leave him. I mean, this chick is terrible.
I know. And that's, again, jumping to a bit I wasn't expecting in terms of them it sort of bringing in the real world, which I kind of liked, you know, the whole cartoon world meets live action world. But yeah, they really kind of tried to establish this real... Not established, but very predictable and very cliched. Oh my gosh, your boyfriend happens to be in a band, which we find out later. Not to diss bands that do high school proms, but I was thinking he was going to be rehearsing at some big for some big gig, and you find out he's just doing the high school prom and setting up a few Casio keyboards.
Absolutely, but of course, you know, and when once she reveals that her parents died in a tragic... Her parents died in the plane crash because she wouldn't go to the beach with them, which was an interesting jump.
Now, Trevor, you being a big crybaby fan, the John Waters film, I just reminded me of that, where John Waters purposely put that in there. the whole how crybaby's parents both died in a, you know, and it was very much a cliche. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my gosh, 3 years earlier, someone was claiming this in a movie. So I thought it's very convenient. And we see it come back, obviously, with a lot of other plot parts of it, but I just thought it was very convenient and very much cliched. Like, it's been done to death.
Oh, just unbelievable. I mean, and of course, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, her dead parents won't come in to affect anything further down the track, will they? Of course not. Yeah, of course they will.
But I don't know if it...
We've got magical people, so yeah, they're going to.
Especially later on when we see, jumping on a little bit, when we see their bodies inhabited, and they pretty much use the parents to lure her in many ways. But I find it really interesting that they actually found the key of that had landed in the holes in the graveyard. And I think how convenient she just happened to be there to see her dead parents at the graveyard when they stumble on this machine that he thinks is a synthesizer, which I actually think is kind of cool, because knowing the 80s, you could expect something like that actually happening in terms of a synthesizer looking like that.
Yeah, one of those Japanese ones. But I mean, they basically. But when He-Man and crew, you know, inevitably fall through to Earth, because that makes it easier to film these sort of things. When can you just use Earth places rather than having to make alien places for 3/4 of the movie? Which I'm sure wasn't a consideration they had at all to make this cheaper. They basically land in a swamp, and everything lands nearby except for this key, which flies through to the middle of a graveyard. I mean, from what I could see, these guys landed a fair way out of town. So I can't see them just going, whoops, and this key, which was attached to like a rope with a claw on the end of it.
Oh, that's right, because they rescue it out the last town minute.
and falling down from enough of a height to make an actual impact crater, almost like it fell from orbit. It's like, that doesn't work. But then we are talking about a movie where the bad guy is a dude in a rubber skeleton mask. So,
but that's it. Just thinking about it, because they aside from the key, the crew land outside that diner, which has some very unusual, you know, oh my gosh, we've seen a cow. What the hell is that? And oh, what are these things? This food on sticks, as they're eating a chicken leg. But I was thinking to myself, they really could have just gone, okay, Courtney Cox happens to see the key landed near them as she leaves the diner after work. I don't know why they'd bothered doing the graveyard thing. Probably so they could bring up the whole fact about the dead parents again.
They really, yeah, again, because it's quite key how evil Lynn eventually tricks Julie into handing over the key. What the hell that happens?
Gasp.
They do build it up. I mean, I think there's even a bit where Courtney Cox goes back to her home and you see her looking longingly at the family photo with a bit of sad music after we get a bit of licensed 80s music of Living in a Box when Kevin picks her up. Just a sudden 80s tune. Another one cuts in a bit later on. They've got two random 80s tunes that just rock up into this movie that's full of bombastic orchestral score for the rest of it.
But I do love how, I mentioned earlier, I do love how the boyfriend's a musician, and I'm thinking, how's this going to work in, or a DJ, I suppose. I don't know if musician's the right term, and we find out later on that it does sort of come in handy. But God, Trevor, is it just me when you watch an 80s movie, whenever there's a scene where they go into a record shop, in this case it was more, an instrumental music shop, but you're looking in the background for any reference to anything of the era, I kind of get excited. I think I saw a few, my excitement died when I saw a few posters for a Moog album, or is it Moog? I think it's Moog albums. And I'm thinking, oh, that would have still been a thing in the 80s.
Yeah, I think when they were in the back room, there were a few cool posters on the walls, but I can't quite recall off the top of my head.
It wasn't exactly a pretty in pink scenario. We had to work with what we had, but I'm thinking, how's this music thing going to come in? But I thought it was quite interesting how the boyfriend is setting up at the prom, but my experience of setting up events or possibly setting up things like this, there'd be still people around. They wouldn't set up really early in the day and leave it for a few hours while he plays with his music and Courtney Cox is left there alone to be targeted by this gang. But I think even later on when the cops come in, the boyfriend goes, oh, I've only been gone for like 10 minutes. You're like, dude, that was ages ago.
Yeah, well, one thing I noticed about this town is as soon as it was sundown, like, everyone disappeared. Like, you got these people dressed in outlandish costumes marching through the streets. There's actual, like, laser battles going on. There's people going through on flying platforms and beast creatures and all sorts of things. And there is nobody around except for these characters. And then a little bit later on, a policeman turns up. But there is nobody else. The streets are deserted. Why is the music shop even open? There's nobody on the streets to go in there.
It's just very convenient.
And the only time the rest of the police turn up is so that they can go, oh, look at this police guy. He's going crazy. He's talking about these costumed people firing lasers that we can't see anywhere.
Then as we see later on, the cop becomes a bit of the... I don't know if they were trying to make him kind of the person we could relate to. I know obviously Courtney Cox and or her character Julie and her boyfriend, I suppose, are supposed to be someone we relate to. But I think we're supposed to relate to the cock, because even I think 10 or 20 minutes from the end, he's still going, "What am I? Am I in the Twilight Zone?" And we're all supposed to go, "Oh, ha, 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 that's what we'd be saying too."
Well, probably because we maybe needed a character that could put the lid on what's going on.
I did like how things ended for him, but I don't want to jump ahead too much, even though I know we're jumping all over the place.
Yeah, whatever. But I mean, Courtney Cox, Julie, she just kind of accepts stuff very, very quickly. Okay, you're from...
Yep.
You're from another planet. Okay, that's cool. I'll let you protect me. The boyfriend who first meets evil Lynn and her bad guys, and they rough him up and put a collar on him to make him tell the truth... His only reaction is that he thinks that they're more of the same people until Courtney Cox convinces that they're the good guys, and his massive bleeding head suddenly heals. Because from one scene, there's just a massive lot of blood going to the side of his face, and then it cuts away from him and cuts back, and his face is clean. I couldn't help but notice that.
And I went to take the movie back about 30 seconds. I don't know if I heard it properly, but when Julie actually does get reunited with her boyfriend, I think it's when after the attack at the prom. I think the first thing she says is, "We've got to tell all our friends." Like, but I didn't see it as to warn them. It was more like, "Oh my god, you can't believe what just happened." It's like she thinks it's fantastic, and whereas you've got the cop who still, even to the last 5 minutes of the movie, still doesn't even believe what's happening. She just accepts it so well, especially that part where she ends up ringing the house, which I think is funny because. The boyfriend is just happens to have brought the cop to the house at the moment that she happens to ring. But she's like, "Great, this thing's just happened." You know, it's almost like she accepts He-Man as being a costumed character from a Halloween party and just runs with it without even questioning anything.
But then I was also wondering, you know, Kevin would have been worried about her, and I don't know why he even bothers pretending it's not her on the phone with the cop there. There seems to be no reason for him to do that, other than he just doesn't want the cop near Julie for some reason. But Julie's leaving him anyway. Wasn't that what he established at the front? So Kevin, just say, "Oh, hi, Julie, are you okay?" And then the cop would be happy.
Considering later, in the second, the third half of the movie, I suppose, we'll say the finale, he just sort of, accepts it so well. And I think there's even one part where, you know, in one section, he's going, "What's happening?" And, you know, the next scene, he's just sitting back and letting all this stuff happen around him. So, yeah, a bit worried about the police in that town. There's not much protection, especially there's no one on the streets when all this wild stuff's happening.
Well, for a while I thought he was the only policeman in town, because you certainly don't see anybody else responding to all this chaos happening in the main street.
And you're talking about all the gang attacking. I thought, you know, I don't know really what they could have done as an alternative, but I do think it's cool that they've got all these hovercrafts and all these, the way that they kind of, you know, get around and manage to get to Earth, and then they break down a door and a light comes on. I don't know. I was kind of expecting a bit more of a better entrance than what they do. It was just kind of like, knock door down, and a whole heap of people in these masks. And, you know, not knowing the characters, but knowing that they they still put some effort in it and, you know, to try and emulate these characters. But a lot of those costumes just look literally like something out of a Halloween party.
From what I remember, I mean, are very vague recollections, but I think, you know, they didn't do too badly with the costumes. If you look at, I suppose, the characters from the cartoons, given what they were working with, and obviously quite a low budget, and some gloriously 80s effects. Oh my goodness, some of those effects were just wow.
I know. Looking back,
they would look cheesy even in the late 80s. So it was just a certain bit of nostalgia, just going, effects used to be this bad. Yeah.
The one that comes to mind is later in the, you know, towards the end where He-Man's getting whipped and it's just that red, you know, the red CGI whipping him, and it's just funny because you're seeing him as an actor ignoring the light, just writhing around.
And it moves so slowly as well, because obviously they couldn't animate it too fast.
As I mentioned earlier, with the costumes being a bit, you know, a bit shocking sometimes, or not shocking, but just seem a bit out of place. I think it was just the whole taking them out of their world and putting them on Earth. They're always going to have that sort of jarring look about them, but I appreciated that part of it. I just think they could have delved into it a bit more. But I suppose we had the, what's his name? I've got to rummage through my notes. But the Gilador, the dwarf, he seemed to be the, I don't know if the comic relief's the right word, but the guy that seems to be stumbling on things. Oh, we can eat this, and oh, we can do this. And it's funny how he manages to work out how to drive a car straight away. But I think he said something about the key manages to do it for him.
Yeah, or he fugged it up. He science fictioned it up somehow and replaced the engine with something else so it would never run out of petrol. Mind you, at the end of it, that car ends up being cut in half, with the front half going back to the home planet when they eventually have the inevitable showdown in the throne room.
Aha,
so
yeah.
It's like, okay, I guess Julie and Kevin won't get to hoon around in that car afterwards.
Well, it's funny because as soon as they got to that area, like I know we see later on sort of what happens to the Earth creatures, but as soon as they get back into that final showdown, I'm thinking to myself, what are they going to do about the humans? But of course, we have to have that final fight with He-Man, and that's actually where it comes to mind, that, as you mentioned, that he's not seen actually slashing anybody or doing anything like that. So it'd be interesting to see it again and see how it's edited, because they wouldn't have shown too much of that.
I actually did notice quite early a lot of the fights with He-Man, aside from this general back and forth, which was fine, but anytime they had to show He-Man flourishing his sword, it was always just a front-on shot of Dolph Lundgren just swinging the sword around himself without actually hitting anything else.
I did like, you know, not knowing anything about He-Man, you know, I definitely recognized the very iconic, you know, was it I Have the Power, when he poses with the sword, and I'm like, yeah, you have to have that in the movie, that you have to have that bit there. But I don't know if it was around here, but I mentioned Skeletor's makeup, but, you know, being very restricted around his mouth, but I don't know if he was very limited, but his eyes were twitching so much, I noticed. I'm thinking to myself, he's probably trying to hold back tears from this mask or these prosthetics, but I definitely noticed that in the last bit. Maybe that was part of the character.
I think he was just acting as manically as possible, and all we could see was the wide eyes going, "Ooh, ooh, I'm insane! Ooh!" Oh, God, Skeletor. I mentioned it before, Frank Langella had so much fun playing this role. Like the fact that you can see how much he enjoyed it and how much he put into it despite being behind this mask the entire movie. You know, I almost felt like applauding him at the end. It was just how anyone can pull that off in that costume. You know, he should have got a bloody Oscar. I mean, honestly, he's giving it his all, and he's having a great time and is saying the most ridiculous lines whilst not falling over laughing. So good job, Frank.
And I think that works too, because it's almost like if you're going to do a film of this kind where it's a live action version, not saying that people were ready to take the Mickey out of He-Man at that time, but you're going to run with it and have a bit of fun with it. I think it sort of shows how the others are probably taking it too serious, but it's good that they played it like that, because it means he stands out, and that's what makes the villain so much more, I suppose, delicious, I suppose, even with this movie. So yeah, I think he's just run with it, and I'm sure his son would have been very impressed.
Absolutely. Or horrified, as the case may be.
He might have been over it by the time the movie came out.
Who knows? I'm trying to think. There's so much... I mean, this movie goes at a super fast pace, so there's a lot of stuff that happens in here. I mean, we pretty much, I think we're getting to the point where we pretty much do have to start wrapping this up anyway. So we did talk about, I suppose, how, I mean, they all get back to He-Man and Co.'s home planet after it's revealed that the cosmic key uses musical tones. Oh, look, Kevin's a keyboard player. and they set up this contraption so he can play a keyboard at the key, which opens up the gate so they can go straight back into the throne room, so we don't need to create sets for any other part of Eternia, which is handy.
Because we knew that music would come in handy for him at some stage.
But yeah, and just this whole, the final battle and between He-Man and Skeletor was, I mean, He-Man doesn't say a lot, but Skeletor just doesn't stop talking about how great and how evil he is and how he's going to take over everything and steal the Sorcerer's power, even though he's told us that about 5 times previous. and then, despite having access to all the power of Grayskull, which was meant to be as soon as Moonrise happened, which happened, but the Sorceress didn't die, and yet everyone could still fight him. And then he just suddenly loses it, just for no, just fighting. He stumbles a bit, and then bang, this magical armor he was wearing suddenly disappears, and he's back to his heavy death robes. Okay, why did that happen? I don't know, but it means He-Man gets the sword back and goes, I have the power! Which...
We it's just giving him excuse for saying that.
The entirety of the movie. Yes. He had to say it eventually.
But talking about the end, I do like how the bumbling cop, we'll call him that, that was spending the whole time going, what the hell's happening? I love how he just, we don't see this, but we just see where he's pretty much like, yeah, I'm going to stay here. And he's somehow looks like he's replacing Skeletor in some way. And he's like, I'm happy here. This is my retirement. I've got my wife or whatever. So it didn't seem to take much convincing. Yeah. Whereas I get the feeling they would have liked Julie and the boyfriend to stay around, but they just wanted to get back to Earth and eat some more chicken legs and ribs.
Yeah, or Hungry Jack's, because at one point he's cleaning up the kitchen and for no reason there's like a Hungry Jack's bag and,
they played for
and stuff.
They paid for a little bit of sponsorship, and I wouldn't be surprised if there was He-Man toys at Hungry Jack's around that time. I'm not sure, but I do like in the end credits how they actually said special thanks to Casio. I thought with the amount of keyboards that we saw in this movie, I'm glad they got a credit.
And because a lot of the fighting action takes place in that music, so we saw a lot of keyboards getting blown up.
So they would have needed a lot of to be contributed. But yeah, so, well, it did have a small budget, but considering the movie that they were making, but maybe a lot of them went to keyboards, I'm not sure.
Yes. And despite Julie saying, oh no, just send us home, after being told she could be sent back in time as well as through space, good old Turdface Guldor sends her back in time so she can stop her parents getting on that plane by saying that she wants to go to the beach.
The thing that I found weird about it was, I'm sure when she first mentioned that story, she was a lot younger, so are we just supposed to assume that she's... yeah, I don't know. They just kept living.
I don't know.
I didn't want to analyze it too much. It's Master of the Universe, like.
But then I think what that scene showed was that it really wasn't her fault, because despite her saying that, the parents just said, "Oh no, you study. We've got work to do. Julie, your parents don't want to go to the beach with you." She ends up stealing their keys and running out of the house in her polka dot nightie.
But isn't the father like I think the father's the pilot, though, or something like that? They said something about...
Yeah.
And then she steals his logbook and map. But I love how she just wraps up his book and a map. But I'm thinking, I'm not knowing much about pilots, but I'm sure that that doesn't mean he can find out other... Yeah, I'm sure there was an alternative. Oh, shit, my daughter's stolen my map and my logbook. I can't come into work today.
I think the keys would have just been enough. Having that map and logbook was just overkill.
That was odd.
Yep. And then she meets up with Kevin, who goes, oh, it was all real. And they have their magic gem that they got. And as it fades in and we close in on the gem, we see a very dodgy model of Castle Grayskull. And then He-Man again going, I have the power.
We've got to milk it one more time.
Super bombastic music cuts back in for the closing credits. Until it finally fades to that cheesy end bit with Skeletor coming out of bubbling liquid going, I'll be back. Yeah, good job, Straight to camera and everything.
I bet. Wow. I'm wondering if, yeah, because I was watching the DVD, I'm wondering if on the Blu-ray release, or if it ever gets one, I wonder if they'll cut that little bit out at the end so fans don't get excited about a possible second movie.
There would probably be a riot amongst fans of this movie if they cut that bit
It has
out.
A big cult following, I've heard. So, yeah, there's definitely its fans out there. And I don't know if that's a segue, Trevor.
Well, we're not quite to that point yet because we do, now that we have, I suppose, talked about only a portion of the things that happened in this movie, a lot happens. We do need to, I suppose, examine the redeemability of Masters of the Universe from 1987. So you did pick this one, Christian, so I guess I shall go first. Good Lord, this was a silly movie. I don't remember too much of the original cartoon, but I'm pretty sure this movie only really has a passing resemblance. It was so predictable, and it hits nearly every bad movie beat. It's got the opening narration, it's got bad costumes, it's got bad effects, there's overacting, there's underacting, it's full of one-note characters, and there's some really, really dodgy editing and camera work to cover up the less than stellar choreography during those action scenes. The music was just way too bombastic for the movie, I felt, with a couple of token 80s tunes thrown in. Saying all that, though, this movie was fun. I don't know if it's right that I did this, but I did enjoy watching this enough to say that, hell yeah, this movie's redeemable. I had a ball.
Wow. Oh my gosh, Trevor. Yeah, the opinion's a bit different to what I thought, but I'm glad you enjoyed it. Because, yeah, what a wild ride, and I think you summed that up. Sorry, I'm just segueing now into my thoughts, but you did sum it up before when you said what a wild ride, and the fact that now 47 went past pretty quickly. Look, I won't make any secret of it. I'm not a fan of animation, and I love when they take a concept, especially an animated concept, and bring it to Earth, essentially. And I love the concept of Masters of the Universe meet Earth people and how they deal with it. Such a great idea that I think I would have liked to have seen explored a little bit more. But look, I've just got a few notes here on a page, but I'm not going to rattle around too much. That troll got a bit annoying, ended up saving the day. Look, they threw in as many special effects as they can, but for a movie of the 80s, especially a movie based on a cartoon of this kind, what else would they have done? The creature makeup, whilst very clever, sometimes seemed quite gaudy, especially in a lot of those scenes with the Earth people. But look, Trevor, look, I'm rambling. It's on the cusp for me. I wouldn't normally redeem this movie, but I'm going to redeem this movie because exactly what you said. It's an enjoyable ride, and whilst I'm not a He-Man fan, I still fan enough to not have it bore me.
Well, there we go. We have redeemed Masters of the Universe from 1987.
Wow.
I think, yeah. Yeah, yeah, for being a wild ride. Wow. I always feel good when I can say that. Hooray. And, I mean, you just redeemed it. I think I enjoyed it a bit more than you. But this movie has its big fans. So I do like to finish on the most redeeming note possible. That's why I go back to Amazon and find a review to wrap things up. So the title of this review is The Great Grandfather of Movies Based on Toys. The Great Grandfather of Movies Based on Toys. It sort of rides alongside Flash Gordon in The Camp Factor, but who cares? Frank Langella has a blast playing Skeletor, and he's clearly having so much fun, he finds a way to make that radiate through 50 pounds of makeup. The budget restrictions are obvious, and in that sense, it's a shame that the crew had to spend more time on Earth than Eternia. The music is awesome, and the cast goes for it. If you're craving 80s fantasy nostalgia, this is a fun movie. 5 stars.
Wow, so it seems to have a bit of a love-hate fandom, but it does have a very big cult following, so yeah, they definitely exist out there.
Indeed they do. I know you don't like the term, but this is one of those movies where so bad it's good kind of can fit in.
Oh, definitely. So, yeah. And I think when they've kind of got that feeling going in, and I'm talking about Skeletor, when a few of the actors are in on the joke, I think that term definitely applies. I think it seems to work all around for this one.
Absolutely. So, wow, we've redeemed Masters of the Universe. And you know what else I realized, Christian? That our next episode is going to be our 2018 season finale.
Oh, my gosh.
So, absolutely no pressure on me. I know, it snuck up on me super fast.
I was going to say, and we're giving this job to Trevor. Oh, look out.
yes. Well, kind of given it to me, but I'll get into that, now, I guess.
Okay.
And yeah, like I said, it snuck off on me super, super fast that the 2018 season finale for the Rufus Project is coming up. So I've dug up something a little extra special. Now, in recent times, there's been a bit of a big push to expand a particular popular movie franchise with mixed results. However, early attempts occurred all the way back, even as far back as 1984. And we have covered some of tangential stuff to this particular franchise previously as well. This is also a bit of a request from an individual who will be joining us to discuss this movie.
Oh, wow.
So, at the suggestion of actor, dancer, and advocate for Queensland actors and the Queensland film industry, Rachel Lee, who has also just started her own podcast, On Set with Rachel Lee, she has us watching Caravan of Courage, an Ewok Adventure.
It's so fun. I laugh because as a cult movie exhibitor, I often get a lot of requests to screen these particular movies. And due to the George Lucas situation, we've never been able to do it. So all I've ever seen of these movies is they seem like there's something like a Willow type film. And so that's probably all I know going in. So I'm keen to give that a go and keen to welcome Rachel in there as well.
Absolutely. Now, digging around for this movie, is just called The Ewok Adventure. So if you do go looking for it, you may just have to search for that. Don't bother looking on any other streaming services because it's not available on any of those. Sorry to do that for you two podcasts in a way, but you're kind of on your own for this one, guys.
You'll have to go off memory or our recommendation.
Absolutely. So, I've never actually seen this one. It's one of the few Star Wars related things I have not seen, which is scary considering we've seen the Star Wars Holiday Special.
I was going to say, you've seen that and Phantom Menace and not this.
Speaking of ghosts of podcast past.
Oh, I said I wasn't going to reference anymore. Damn it. It's too hard.
I brought up that Holiday Special that we weren't naming in. So, Warwick Davis, you mentioned the Willow thing. Warwick Davis is in this movie as the main Ewok. So,
oh, okay.
There we go. Excellent. So, probably we shall move on quickly. Now, if you have any comments about Caravan of Courage, an Ewok Adventure, or Caravan of Courage, or the Ewok Adventure, take your pick. All those seem to work. Or if you feel that you want to still have your say about Masters of the Universe, you can get in touch with us super duper easily. You can find our homepage at rufusproject.com and leave a comment below this episode. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook very, very easily. You can send us an email to podcast@rufusproject.com. We're on Stitcher now as well, so I'm pretty sure you can leave a comment on Stitcher. If you are so inclined, I'll just say, because I'm still super proud of it, that we're on Spotify! Woohoo! But you can't leave a comment there.
You can just listen to us lots and lots and lots because there's many episodes.
Absolutely. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute too. Oh, God, I've got so much to talk about in the plugs. So definitely get in touch with us. Like I said, we are wrapping up for the season. Now, we will, of course, have our Irredeemable Christmas special. That's still to be finalized. So if you have any suggestions for that or movies that we can check out next year, definitely drop us a line about that as well. We would love to hear your suggestions, feedback, thoughts, whatever. Say hi. We would love to hear that.
Oh, and that's the thing, we've done so many movies, but there's still thousands upon thousands more to go. I don't know if that's daunting or a challenge. I'll take it as a challenge.
It means we've still got lots of potential episodes.
Exactly.
Which is good for a podcast.
And yes. Hey, we had a good run tonight, so let's hope our next one ends us on a high note, ignoring the Christmas special, because they're always a bit dubious.
Yes, well, the Christmas special is basically a Christmas present to ourselves because we don't have to try to redeem it, hence the Irredeemable Christmas special. Now, we'll talk more about that next time, of course. But in the meantime, as we're saying, well, Christmas times are coming up and there's quite a few things, I think, happening in the world of Christian Fletcher events.
I know, which I had. It's so funny, actually, looking at my diary, and it's actually getting smaller and smaller because we're at the end of the year. But just a quick ramble. We've got such movies as, we've got some cult movie nights such as Desperately Seeking Susan, Office Space, Tank Girl, Showgirls, Princess Bride and Dirty Dancing are coming out again because they're so popular, Reservoir Dogs and Cabin in the Woods. I've also announced one of my retro parties for January 19th. We're playing all the music from the 50s to the 80s over the course of the night. Probably the best stage at this stage is head to christianfletcher.com or Christian Fletcher Events on Facebook, and I'll start announcing some more very soon for 2019.
Ooh, looking forward to that. Now, okay. Deep breath time. A lot of stuff's happened with the Rufus Project. So, as I mentioned before, we're available on Stitcher and Spotify. Thanks to a tweaking of our database, all our episodes from when we officially crossed over to the Rufus Project podcast a while back, when we left the frontiers of the Podomatic days, if anyone remembers that. So all those episodes from that point onwards are available now in the podcast feed, or of course you can head to our homepage where there's a handy list of all the movies that we've attempted to redeem, where you can click through and go straight through to the podcast that way. We still got the YouTube channel at this point, the Rufus Project YouTube channel, where you get to see video versions of these podcasts. What I am currently working on, which is very exciting, is a new project called Rufus Project TV, ooh, which will be the home to a lot of Rufus Project video content going forward, and there'll be options to subscribe to individual channels on that as well. It's all very much in beta at the moment. It may be launched by the time this podcast goes out, but I'm not making any promises just yet.
Ooh, lots happening. And,
I know, I'm exhausted. Like I said, we are coming up to the season finale of the Rufus Project, but I will also be launching the Rufus Project Rehashed, I've decided to call it, which will be going out over the break, and that will be a re-release of our older episodes from Podomatic on the current feed, so that everything is available for you to stream, listen to, no matter where you listen to it. Ooh. At this point, I'll only be releasing the movie-related ones, so if you do want to get some of the other mini episodes that we used to do, even though we talk about stuff that was very current at that particular time and has absolutely no relevance anymore, you can let me know, and I might release them in some form or another if you so desire, or you can just head to our homepage.
So they exist, which is good.
They exist. Now, you've also got What the History for some more fun podcasty stuff, which my wife Susie and I put out every fortnight, where we take a couple of bizarre bits of history and share that with you. So that will be our latest episode, which should be live by the time this comes out. So that's at wthpod.rufusproject.com or on Stitcher or on Spotify. Anyone who listens to What the History, by the way, we've got to thank you guys. When we first put it on Spotify, it was buried deep. Within a week, we were within the top 10 results searching for What the History. So thank you to everyone out there who helped with that.
Fantastic. Boy. Oh my God, so many plugs, but it's all good news, which is great.
Yeah, I think I'm done. But there'll be links and references and all sorts of stuff in the podcast description. So click maniacally and you'll find stuff everywhere. Rufus Project kind of exploded.
Oh, it's a good thing. Times. Oh, it's fantastic.
Yes. Whew, I'm exhausted now, so I think we better start thinking about wrapping this up, Christian.
Oh, for sure. So I'm looking forward to checking out our next movie. So The Ewok Adventure, Caravan of Courage, 1984. ran the other way, but you know where I'm going with that.
Again, from what I've seen, just pick any part of that title you just used and it all works. So, and I'm looking forward to having Rachel on. We haven't had a guest for a while, so it'll be very, very cool to have her on for our season finale. Oh, my goodness, I still can't get over that.
I can't believe it.
Indeed. So so on that note, I hope you all enjoy watching whatever you enjoy watching, and we will see you next time. Farewell.
In a galaxy far, far away, a brother and sister search for their missing parents.
How are we going to find them?
We will. Don't worry.
And fate leads them to the magical Ewoks.
We help you.
Now, a great adventure begins. Sheer enchantment and excitement, says the Hollywood Reporter. Help! From deadly traps to daring escapes.
That was close. You guys were great.
It's an action-packed motion picture featuring incredible special effects from the award-winning team of Industrial Light and Magic.
That's Mommy and Daddy.
Sometimes when you search for the impossible, an unbelievable adventure unfolds.
I wish we had furry creatures like you where I came from.
Don't miss The Ewok Adventure, now on video cassette from MGM UA Home Video.
So bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? It's got bad dialogue, dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy. Oh boy.
Christian and Trevor on the case, watching movies from all over the place. IMDb says it's bad, but we want to know, is it fun to be had?
Boy. Oh boy.
Redeeming features.
By the power of Grayskull!